Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Diamond Shamrock versus Mendez.
May it please the court, Mr. Benjamin Paul will present argument to petitioner.
May it please the court, Wendell Hall for petitioner. This is an invasion of privacy case arising out of the discharge of a plaintiff's employment from the Diamond Shamrock Refinery in Three Rivers, Texas. The common law invasion of privacy was recognized by this court in Billings versus Atkinson in the 60s, and later in the Industrial Foundation of the South versus Texas Industrial Accident Board, this court recognized four distinct varieties of invasion of privacy that Dean Prosser had recognized in his California Law Review article in 1960. Of the four types of invasion of privacy, only one of those types of invasion of privacy requires falsity as an element of the cause of action. That is the false light theory of invasion of privacy, which is at issue in this case. Three elements are required to prove false light theory of invasion of privacy. First, you must place the person in a false light. Second, the defendant must give widespread publicity to the false matter. Third, the defendant must act with knowledge or reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized matter, or, as the Court of Appeals, which Diamond Shamrock intends erroneously held, must either know or act negligently in terms of publicizing the false matter. The defendant's entitled to rendition of judgment for several reasons. First, there's absolutely no evidence of falsity. Second, there is no evidence of widespread publicity. Third, there's no evidence that Diamond Shamrock acted with knowledge or intentional or reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized matter, or even if the negligent standard of care is adopted, that it acted negligently. Finally, the plaintiff's failure to obtain a finding on the standard of care, which is an essential element of the false light theory of invasion of privacy, entitles Diamond Shamrock to rendition of judgment, since Diamond Shamrock properly objected to the omission of the standard of care from the jury question regarding false light invasion of privacy. With respect to the evidentiary issue on falsity, unlike defamation where a defendant must prove truth, in a false light invasion of privacy case, that falsity is an essential element of the plaintiff's claim, so it is his burden to prove that the matter publicized was in fact false.
In that regard, Mr. Mendez initially said he had no intent to steal the mails. Later on, when confronted, in response to a question, said, I guess so. And then the jury heard all that evidence, and apparently the jury found that he had no intent to steal. Why is that not dispositive on that particular element?
Your Honor, that is an absolute incorrect interpretation of the record. What the record actually reflects is that at the time of trial, Mr. Mendez testified, I didn't intend to steal the nails. That's not the time at which you measure the truth or falsity of the publicized matter. The restatement says that the truthness or the falsity of the publicized matter is determined at the time that it is publicized. And that would have been on the day of his discharge or within a few days after, not 4 years later when the case is tried. At the time that the alleged statement was publicized, there is not a shred of evidence to dispute his admission of theft, which the Court of Appeals even recognized later in its opinion in disposing of the intentional infliction of emotional distress.
What admission did he make? Could you articulate the language for me?
Yes, Your Honor. What occurred was his lunch bag contained a box of nails.
So we're familiar with the facts.
And he was presented with that in the office in a private meeting with John Hoffman and Wayne Billings. The testimony reflects that he described the situation, what had occurred, and why the box of nails was in his lunch bag. John Hoffman testified that he characterized that conduct as stealing and asked Mr. Mendez if he agreed. Mr. Mendez said, yes, I guess so. Then Mr. Hoffman made the decision to discharge the plaintiff. Mr. Hoffman then left the room. After Mr. Hoffman left the room, Wayne Billings then said, basically, and I'm summarizing the testimony, Mr. Mendez, why didn't you come to me? We have gate passes to take this sort of stuff out of the plant. You know, why didn't you come to me? I don't want to do this, but I don't have any choice. And Mr. Mendez replied, I don't know. I guess I just messed up.
But the bag wasn't removed from the plant.
That's not necessary.
As I understand the circumstances, he was on the job. Correct me if I'm wrong or leave anything out. He was on the job. One of the supervisors talked to him and told him he didn't appreciate some debris laying around, told him to clean it up or something like that. He cleaned it up. There were some loose nails. He put the nails in a box, put the box in a lunch bag, which he left on the premises. It was later discovered, open. The nails were discovered. He was called back to the job. And he was interrogated in the manner that you described.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals even agreed in disposing the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim that Hoffman and Billings were entitled to rely on his admission of theft. The Court of Appeals found that to be true in disposing of the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, but didn't find it to be true in disposing of the false lie claim. And the reason for that is they didn't measure the truthfulness or the falsity of his statement at the time it was publicized. They then went to the plaintiff's testimony at the time of trial, which was 4 years later, when he said, no, I didn't intend to steal the nails. That's not when you measure the truthfulness of a statement in either a defamation action or a false light action. It has to be measured at the time that it's publicized. And at the time it was publicized, there is no evidence, contrary to the plaintiff's admission, that he intended to steal the nails. While it was Mr. Hoffman's characterization of it, he agreed with it and never recanted it, never suggested, no, that's not what I intended to do. As a matter of fact, Mr. Mendez's wife's testimony reflects that when he got home, he told her he intended to bring the nails home. Mr. Mendez says he didn't recall saying that to her, but that she certainly could have assumed that from the circumstances of what had occurred. But at the time of the alleged publication, there is no evidence that the statement was not true or was in fact false. With respect to the issue of widespread publicity, this court in Industrial Foundation of the South and also Moore versus Big Picture Company, a Fifth Circuit case, a diversity case interpreting Texas law, had the occasion to define what is exactly publicity, and both this court and the Fifth Circuit interpreting Texas law have adopted the restatement's definition in 652, restatement of torts, section 652D, comment A, which is basically, as this court described it, publicity requires communication to more than a small group of persons. It must be communicated to the public at large such that it becomes one of public knowledge. Well, there's absolutely no evidence in this case that Diamond Shamrock communicated the reason for the plaintiff's discharge to anyone.
How then, when Mr. Mendez and his wife spoke to several individuals, they already knew, a lot of them did, that the reasons for his termination was firing.
The inference is just as likely, the circumstantial evidence leading to that inference is just as likely that they learned it from other people that they did tell the reason for the discharge. Mr. Mendez and his family both all testified that they told some people. They discussed this with approximately 200 people in the Three Rivers community. Some people already knew the reason for the discharge. Apparently, some did not. The inference is just as equally likely that they heard it from others who the family had already told the reason for the discharge. But the courts have been very specific about this publicity issue, and the problem is, and as the commentators have described, and even Dean Prosser recognized in his 1960 article about false light, that there was the serious likelihood of this false light invasion of privacy action engulfing the defamation action. And that's why they've been very specific about the publicity requirement. It has to be more than just to a few people, and you have to tie the publication of the false matter to the actor, and that would be Diamond Shamrock. And there is no evidence, there is not even inference, there's not a scintilla of evidence, there's not circumstantial evidence that Diamond Shamrock communicated the reason for the discharge to anyone in the plant or to anyone in the community. And there are a number of cases, and they're cited in our brief, that employees merely gossiping about the reason for a person's discharge, or the fact that people in the community may hear about the discharge or the reason for the discharge, is no evidence that the actor, in this case Diamond Shamrock, gave widespread publicity to the alleged false matter, which here would be the reason for the discharge. And the commentators have been, and in the other cases that have interpreted that publicity requirement, have been very strict about enforcing that. And I think that's probably because most of these cases arise are media cases. and they're balancing the concerns of the media's First Amendment rights versus a private individual's right of redress for having their either being placed in a false light or having their injury, their reputation defamed. With respect to the standard of care, Diamond Shamrock objected at the trial of this cause that the plaintiff omitted from his jury question on false light invasion of privacy that the element of knowledge, reckless disregard had been omitted from the jury question. The trial court overruled the objection, and the issue was submitted without the standard of care. Of course, after oral argument in the Court of Appeals, the plaintiff filed a post-submission brief in which he then urged that the negligent standard of care be adopted, and the Court of Appeals did adopt the negligent standard of care, which in my view, the court was just working too hard to find for the plaintiff because on the one hand, on the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, they found that Diamond Shamrock's conduct was neither intentional nor reckless. And so if they found that to be true, they couldn't leave the restatement definition of knowledge, reckless disregard alone. They had to change it to negligence. Because if they found for us on the intentional infliction, they would have to find for us also on the false light claim because it's the same standard of care as recited in the restatement. Now, if this court wants to chooses to adopt the negligent standard of care, it's sort of a distinction without a difference. All an employer is going to do is assert the qualified privilege, which they're entitled to do under the restatement, because the qualified privileges applicable to defamation causes of action are equally applicable to false light causes of action. So if you assert the qualified privilege, then the employee has the burden to establish knowledge, reckless disregard. So what have you really done? All you've done is insist that the defendant employer assert the qualified privilege, which is already built into the restatement's definition as it stands now, or as it stood before the Court of Appeals opinion. And in this case, what's so ironic about it is the Court of Appeals concludes that Diamond Shamrock waived its objection because I suppose it should have known that on appeal, the standard of care was going to be changed from knowledge, reckless disregard to negligence. And as a result, the Court of Appeals concluded that Diamond Shamrock waived its objection to the charge, and therefore it then decided not to even address the legal and factual sufficiency challenges to the standard of care element that Diamond Shamrock had raised in its brief. And under Rule 279, that they had the right to raise those evidentiary challenges, and the Court of Appeals simply chose not to address them based upon its ruling that the issue had been waived by Diamond Shamrock and not objecting based upon the negligent standard of care, which of course the Texas cases at that time that had recited the false light standard or the false light cause of action all recited the restatement elements, which included the knowledge, reckless disregard standard of care. Finally, with respect to the plaintiff's burden, he has, of course, the burden to obtain a finding on all essential elements of his cause of action. And one of the essential elements of his cause of action is either the negligent standard of care or the reckless disregard standard of care. At the time of trial, Diamond Shamrock objected based upon the laws that existed at the time. Failing to obtain a finding on that under this court's decision on September 11th, I think, in State Department of Highways versus Payne and also McKinley versus Stripling, Diamond Shamrock would be entitled to rendition of judgment because the plaintiff did not obtain a jury finding on an essential element of his claim. And it can't be construed to be a deemed finding, because Diamond Shamrock challenged both the legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence of the standard of care, whether it was knowledge, reckless disregard, or negligence in its brief before the Court of Appeals. It's just the Court of Appeals opted not to address those issues, and we think unfairly.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ravin Binya, and I represent the respondent in this case, Roque Mendez, Your Honors. The facts of this case sometimes are characterized by petitioner in obviously the light it feels is more applicable and more favorable to it. However, I think several of the justices have already alluded to the fact of some very important facts in this case. And the first fact is that Mr. Mendez never removed these nails, these handful of nails, from Diamond Shamrock's property. That, in and of itself, would prevent a finding in a criminal action under 3101 of the Penal Code. And I'm not a criminal lawyer, Your Honors, but I've read that. And under 3101, even a temporary withholding is insufficient to find a theft finding in a criminal action. Respondent, or petitioner rather, continues to state, secondly, that Mr. Mendez admitted to the fact that he had stolen these nails in light of them never having been removed. On page 92 of the record, the testimony, the only testimony at trial, is very clear, and Justice Gamage alluded to that. The only thing that Mr. Mendez said after his two supervisors questioned him, after he explained the situation, the circumstances under which this had occurred, they said, "Rocky, we see your lunch bag, we see company property in your lunch bag, and that's stealing. Wouldn't you agree?" And Mr. Mendez, sitting there, thinking he was going to get 5 or 10 days without pay, "Yeah, I guess so." He didn't say yes. 92 says, "I guess so."
Was there ever any evidence in the record of why he was putting company property in his personal lunch bag?
Yes, Justice Cook. In fact, the record shows that what occurred around 5:30 in the morning, he's on graveyard shift. He was ordered by his supervisor to clean up after crews that had been there for several weeks, and they'd been constantly cleaning up these crews over which he had no authority, over which he had no say-so, in order for some inspection. And because these crews had continued, just left these things scattered around, he just grabbed them. And the evidence shows that he could have either just thrown them away, and in anger, basically, he just threw them in his lunch bag, which was a paper sack, is what it amounted to. That was it. Now, in order for a jury, which was sitting there, what were they viewing? They were witnessing someone who had gotten temporarily angry, left what he was going to steal in plain view on company property. That is not the action of a thief. Those will not support them. And the jury so found. That is the evidence that we have in regards to that particular point in regards to Diamond Sheriff, point of error number one, in regards to the false statement. And that was and continues to be a false statement in spite of what Diamond Shamrock insists to be. And incidentally, the company, Diamond Shamrock, through its own evidence, Your Honors, introduced into evidence its own handbook, which clearly states that they have the right and the authority to inspect all bags, all instruments belonging to company employees on company premises. So there's still no complete control over any property that an employee has, regardless of that. And therefore, there is sufficient evidence. There's more than a scintilla of evidence to show that was a false statement. The second question, and second no evidence, or subpart B, I should say, is the issue in regards to publicity. Diamond Shamrock would ask this court to completely ignore the record. The evidence shows that Clayson Royale, who was one of the employees, testified, and I examined it in deposition, and it was read into the record. "Mr. Royale, did anyone tell you about Mr. Mendez's termination?" "Yes." "Who told you?" "Wayne Billings, the management human resources director of the plant, one of the three people in that meeting with Mr. Mendez." "What did he tell you?" "He told me that Rocky was fired for stealing." "He told me that Rocky was fired for stealing." And again, he was asked again. The second time it was asked in a leading fashion, and he responded, "Yes." On cross-examination by Diamond Shamrock's counsel, and Mr. Royale, mind you, is still an employee at that time of the deposition, he's asked if those were the precise words that were used. And Mr. Ryle says, well, suddenly had a very quick lapse of memory and said, no, those are perhaps not the words he used exactly, but still on recross by myself admitted that that was the essence of the statement that was made to him. Further, Mr. Ryle stated very categorically and very clearly that before the day was over, Your Honors, that everyone in that plant knew that Mr. Mendez had been terminated for stealing. And therefore, we have sufficient evidence, more than a scintilla of evidence, to support the jury's finding in that regard.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Billings or anyone else in the management of Diamond Shamrock told anybody else other than
Mr. Ryle? Yes, Your Honor. The testimony by Mr. Billings states that he told other supervisors of this particular incident.
And the reason for it?
They maintain today, Your Honor, and Diamond Shamrock continues to maintain in its brief and its argument that they never told anyone, they told no one, for the reason of Mr. Mendez's termination, in direct conflict to Mr. Royale's testimony.
Other than Mr. Royale, is there any evidence that they told anybody else?
Yes, Your Honor. They told four supervisors, including who were supervising Mr. Royale. Yes,
including
Your Honor.
The reason.
No, they maintain the reason was not given to them, Your Honor.
I just want to know, is there any evidence in the record that they told anybody else that he was fired and the reason for it other than Mr. Royale?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The fact remains, though, Justice Heck, that there were only three people in that meeting. Mr. Mendez left immediately after his termination.
What were his hours that night?
Your Honor, he was doing the graveyard shift, so he would come in late at night, 11, if I recall, and left approximately 7 o'clock in the morning.
And what time did the, 11 to 7, and what time did the cleanup of the nails and other materials take place?
Approximately from the testimony that was in trial, approximately 5:30, closer to, Mr. Mendez's testimony was that it was close to the end of his shift.
And where did he keep his lunch sack? Because considering that it was 5:30 in the morning, it would not be a lunch break. So where in relationship to the activities he was engaged in was his lunch sack kept?
Mr. Mendez worked in the control room, Your Honor, and he had the lunch bag there in the control with him on the table. It's basically it. It was a large room that had a variety of dials and gauges and things of that nature.
Was it still cracking plant or?
Yes, Your Honor, a cracking plant.
He was an operator.
Yes, Your Honor, an FCC chief operator. So it was in proximity to him that evening, yes, Your Honor, or that morning, rather.
So this, when he was asked to clean up this mess, that was not part of his ordinary duties and routine?
No, Your Honor, and in fact, the evidence shows that had been a bone of contention between the FCC chief operators, whose responsibility is to make sure that this plant operates not only efficiently, but that danger does not occur that would, in essence, cause some kind of catastrophic event to occur in the community, because that's what they do. They make sure that those...
I suppose their job is to constantly monitor the dials and for pressure, for flow,
exactly.
For what have you, and to regulate it.
Exactly.
What was his explanation as to why he put the nails in his lunch sack as opposed to a trash receptacle?
It was just his anger. There was really no real explanation, Judge. It was just a situation that he was in. He grabbed them, and his lunch bag was there, and he just threw them in there.
When you say his lunch bag, what was the makeup, the composition of the lunch bag?
It's a paper sack, Your Honor, one of those
brown bag?
I'm sorry?
A brown bag?
Yes, a brown paper bag, yes, Judge.
Was he going to take the brown bag home, or was he going to throw the brown bag away?
There is no evidence one way or the other, Your Honor, in that regard.
There is evidence he never removed it from the premises.
That is very clear.
He left it
on the premises.
In the operating plant where he worked.
Exactly, Your Honor. In control of Diamond Shamrock.
What else was in his brown bag when he was searched?
The remainders of his lunch, bowl, a spoon, plastic bowl drum.
So there were other items in the bag that would have been removed from the facility?
That could have been, yes, Your Honor.
How about the standard of care?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard of care that Diamond Shamrock, first of all, is requesting that this court adopt is that of the actual malice. Obviously, this court has, as well as the United States Supreme Court, has grasped with this particular issue on more than one occasion. But I think that this court in Foster versus Laredo Newspapers clearly set forth what the standard was going to be in regards to private individuals when dealing with publishers or broadcasters.
That's defamation case.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think it is very close, because false light and defamation are very close, Your Honor. I think
what distinguishes the two torts?
What distinguishes the two torts, Your Honor, is that in a slander or libel action, you need only communicate it to one person. The law also presumes in libel and slander, presumes damages. In false light, you must prove a false statement. You must also prove actual damages. You must also show widespread publicity. So there are distinctions between the two. However, there is a lot of commonality in that regard. And
Do you believe the restatement, is counsel in error in saying the restatement requires either intent or reckless disregard?
He is in error from my reading of the restatement, Your Honor, and the reason I state that is because the restatement has a comment and a caveat that deals with the U.S. Supreme Court case of Gertz versus Welsh, Inc., where the United States Supreme Court permits the states to apply a standard that is less rigorous than the actual malice. One of the things about this is the court, if it adopts an actual malice standard, is raising for private individuals to a constitutional level the same standard as we have in the New York Times versus Sullivan test. I don't think that ought to be the law when we're dealing with private individuals who've been injured. The state has a compelling interest to protect individuals who have been injured in cases such as this. And therefore, the negligence standard is a sufficient standard to protect the defendants because they have other limitations that Justice Gonzalez alluded to a little earlier. There are other limitations in the privacy invasion of privacy action.
Did Billings or Industrial Foundation say anything about the standard?
No, Your Honor. They in most of the cases, what occurs is there is a holding and a citing to the restatement. But no case in Texas, other than this particular case, has dealt with the issue of the standard of care in an invasion of privacy case. And to permit or to require an actual malice standard, as I stated a little earlier, is going to require a much higher burden than is necessary under the Gertz and even under the Foster versus Laredo newspaper standard that we have. There should be no distinction between that standard in Foster and in this case, because the publication is the same thing. We're dealing with a publication to a large number of people when we have a private individual as opposed to a public official or a public person.
As you have laid out the two causes of action, is it your position that there's a greater burden, more elements to establish in order to make a recovery for false light than for defamation?
It is not a very simple task to undertake,
really,
Your Honor.
When you bring a false light case, you really assume the responsibility of proving up more elements than and a broader burden than defamation.
Exactly. And that is the continues the protection for defendants in this particular kind of action. As an aside, the fact that this occurs in an employment situation, even though Diamond Shamrock would ask the court that it erodes the at-will employment doctrine, we do not believe that to be the case at all. Actual malice, or malice as defined under the New York Times standard, and which this court may look to in regards to something else, Your Honors. In order for a plaintiff to recover either presumed or punitive damages, then the actual malice standard would be very applicable, because there you're requiring a greater burden on the plaintiff to obtain a verdict from a jury that would require that kind of knowledge on behalf of the publisher. That is what we believe should be the standard, a simple negligence standard in regards to the basic cause of action, but if a plaintiff is seeking to have either presumed or punitive damages, then a much higher standard of actual malice should be required.
How about the alleged inconsistency in the Court of Appeals opinion with regards to the, I believe it was negligent infliction of emotional distress?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if the court reads that, we're dealing with two separate causes of action. And what Diamond Shamrock would ask the court to do is to kind of mix the two up so that we can take portions from intentional infliction and apply them to the false life, because the Court of Appeals was able to make a separate determination in regards to the negligent or intentional infliction of emotional distress. There the court held, in this particular case, the Court of Appeals, stated basically that for the kind of outrageous conduct that is required under that theory, it was not breached. And so as a result, it held that the jury finding that particular aspect of it would not be upheld. But those ought not to be confused. The development of this particular tort in Texas has been very slow. It hasn't developed as Diamond Shamrock or other authors would ask the court to believe. The fact of the matter is that even since Gertz, this court has had very few cases to review in this particular regard. I would hope that when we look at invasion of privacy, the court would look just as it does in other cases. There are substantial obstacles for the plaintiff to overcome in this cause of action, and we would respectfully request that the court affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Gamage, with respect to your question about whether this actually constituted theft or not, under the jury's instruction of theft, the determination was appropriation of property. And appropriation of property under the Black's Law Dictionary only requires exercising control over property. Well, is putting it in your lunch bag exercising control over it? Would he have had to put it in his locker to exercise control of it? His lunch bowl, other items of personal property were in his lunch bag. I think that's exercising control over that property. And it's not like, from my understanding of the record, the exhibits show that this is a 10-inch by 10-inch box of nails. It's not two or three nails just tossed into a bag. I think
a heck of a big lunch bag.
Excuse me?
It's a heck of a big lunch bag, 10-inch by 10-inch box of nails.
I suppose it must have been a grocery bag. If it was a grocery bag, that would certainly fit. I don't know, Your Honor.
Mr. Hall, on a different subject, do you agree with opposing counsel that the burden imposed on the plaintiff in establishing a false light case is broader than that for defamation?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, in a false light case, there are a number of cases when the court looks into some of the law review articles and other cases, all a false light plaintiff has to do is establish that it was false. As a matter of fact, there are some cases where plaintiffs have recovered where they have been portrayed in a flattering manner, where people have been portrayed as heroes and they didn't actually consider themselves to be heroes and didn't want to be portrayed in the public light in that fashion. They sued and recovered and won. I don't think that's a real difficult burden. The two causes of action are completely different. The reason this false light cause of action was brought was because his defamation claim was barred by the statute of limitations. The case was brought 2 years later. Defamation has to be brought within 1 year. False light within 2 years. In defamation, you're protecting reputation. In false light, you're protecting inner feelings, trying to prevent people from invading your inner seclusion, your privacy. They're just completely different types of causes of action. The most difficult burden for a plaintiff to prove, I think, in a false light case is the publicity element. And the reason that the commentators and all the cases have universally agreed that there has to be widespread publicity by the actor is so that this cause of action doesn't just absolutely swallow up the defamation cause of action. And even Dean Prosser in his article in 1960 recognized and had that concern back then. And I think the cases have reflected that concern and have required the plaintiff to prove widespread publicity.
In a defamation case, of course, another distinction as it relates to a defamation claim against a newspaper is that you have a freedom of the press consideration. Isn't it a peculiarity in the law if we say that for defamation against a newspaper, if you're a private individual, you only have to establish negligence, but you have a higher burden against someone where there's no freedom of the press consideration involved.
I understand the distinction, and yes, it is somewhat ironic. On the other hand, all an employer then has to do is assert the qualified privilege, which he's entitled to do, as to a false light claim, and the plaintiff then has the higher burden of knowledge, reckless disregard, as he originally had under the cause of action as set out in the restatement. And I would disagree with opposing counsel. The restatement does not take a position on knowledge or reckless disregard. That's what the caveat says directly below the definition of false light invasion of privacy. It leaves that question open. But within the definition of the cause of action, subsection B, the actor had knowledge of or acted in reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized matter and the false light in which the other would be placed. To me, that's pretty clear. And I understand, since Gertz, that the states are free to impose a lower standard as to media defendants. The problem is with this case is you're pounding a square peg into a round hole. This is really a defamation case that missed the statute of limitations. It couldn't be brought. They tried to bring it as a false light claim and couldn't do it because, for one thing, they can't prove publicity or falsity, and they can't prove publicity.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't want to dwell on the nails, but I was given to understand that he gathered up loose nails, put them in a box, which was described as a small box, put it in his lunch bag, didn't take the lunch bag home with him, left it there for the next operator and supervisor to find, that was turned over to a security supervisor, a woman, who said that the reason she opened the bag is because when she set it down, she heard an unusual noise, and so she opened and found the nails. That and the value of these nails was under $5. That does not describe to me a full box of full 10-inch by 10-inch box of nails. It didn't seem like he was trying to walk away with a crate of them, and he didn't walk away with any of them.
I understand, Your Honor. The evidence reflects in the exhibit, in her report, in Anita Carroll's report, that it's a 10-inch by 10-inch box. That's all that
10-inch by 10-inch box could have five nails in it,
I
10 nails in it.
But, Your Honor,
she picked it up and set it down.
When they asked
her, I don't want to sound sexist, but this is a woman we're talking about, and she sets it down and it rattles, so she opens it up and looks at it. That she wasn't apparently going to look at it until she heard the funny noise. It wasn't the weight of it that caused her to look at it.
Two corrections to your characterization of the facts. First of all, the lunch bag was in the clock house, where they clock out just before they leave, not in the control room where he was working. Yes. So he had taken it there, and he had left it there, clocked out, and just inadvertently forgotten it.
Was there evidence that it was inadvertent?
Pardon?
Is there evidence that it was inadvertent?
No.
Not intentional?
No.
In other words,
just
he might at one point had the intent, but he changed his mind, and that's not stealing.
He just left it there. He did admit, though, and agree with them he was stealing the nails. The Court of Appeals agreed, read that from the record. As far as relying on any other inferences, there just are no other inferences except to accept his admission. I mean, you're doing in hindsight what an employer has to do at the time of the
I understand that, but there's also, isn't it a fact that, number one, these nails were debris? He was told to clean them up. He could have thrown them away. Nobody would have said anything. If he'd asked somebody, say, I found, I was cleaning up. These nails were laying around, so I have to take them home. They would have said, yeah, they got a policy about that. But none of that occurred, and he did not remove them. If he'd have dropped the lunch bag in a trash can in the clock house, when he could have thrown the nails in the trash at his operating site, if he threw them in the trash at the clock house, had he disposed of them any less one way or the other and said, oh, I was going to take these home, but I changed my mind, is that stealing?
No, but it was a violation of company. It would have been a violation of company policy, and that's
but
not what
did
occurred.
They, what did they tell people that he did?
They did not tell people that he did anything. They said that he had been discharged, and that's all the record.
There was evidence, apparently some evidence in the record, that they did tell people he was terminated for stealing.
No, Your Honor, there is not. The only testimony the plaintiff points to is the testimony of Clayson Royal, who testifies finally on cross-examination. I will tell you the truth. I cannot tell you exactly what Billings said.
Well, we
the test of reviewing this jury verdict, we look whether there's some evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. You cannot look at this man's testimony, I don't think, in a vacuum. There was direct examination and cross-examination. At first he said, yes, they told me he was terminated for stealing. And then he says, no, I'll tell you the truth. I cannot remember what Billings said. But let's assume that they told Wayne Billings. That still completely does not satisfy the publicity element. Telling one person simply does not satisfy the publicity element of a false life claim.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the arguments for this morning. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Marshall will adjourn the court.
The audience is please rise. Oh, yay, oh, yay.